15 minutes is my allotted time, but let me use some of it in gratitude. Mary, let me join the chorus. You've done an extraordinary job. Don't shake your head modestly. You have done an extraordinary job. I also want to congratulate Cambridge on 800 years. As it's obvious, I am an American. And except for the indigenous people in America, for us, a centenary is deep, deep in time past. So to think of 800 years strikes me with awe. I also spent two of the happiest years of my life at Cambridge, where I was a student at Newnham, reading for the second part of the Tripos. And I have been walking the streets, noticing the changes, but caught in one of the most beautiful sensations there is, happy nostalgia. I also want to thank you, the audience, for being here at the end of a long day. It seems to me you've either been ripped untimely from your dinners, or your dinner is still waiting for me. In either case, you have quelled your natural appetites and come to listen to us, and I am very grateful for your patience and tolerance. And finally, Don and Liz. Don, I've admired you for so long, and Liz, I've just heard great things about you, so it's an honor to be with you. So here we go. I don't know how many of you were watching YouTube during the first part of 2009, and if you were watching YouTube, and I hope you were, to keep up with our extraordinary culture, you would have seen video clips of demonstrations in France. And there, how many of you saw these? Their purpose was to denounce the President of the Republic, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the reforms in French universities that he and his education minister were initiating. Ah, a cynic might say with a shrug, what's new? And what's new is what the demonstrators were doing. They were giving a group reading of a canonical text in French literature, in English, The Princess of Cleves, published anonymously in 1678 by a woman, the Countess de Lafayette. Now, this technique of resistance was deftly chosen. For in 2006, Sarkozy, plain literary critic, had made some very ill-tempered comments about the Princess of Cleves. Indeed, he had said that his experience of the novel when he was a boy had shown him that the novel was unreadable, and in English, translation, only an imbecile or a sadist could have chosen to set it as an examination text. A bit of literary criticism that it's a warning against autobiographical criticism. His language seemed not only Philistine, but vulgar, and if you read the French, tediously sexist. But in brief, because official power was simultaneously attacking the humanities, French culture, women writers, and the universities that protect and defend them all, official power had to be resisted. And as an act of resistance, the demonstrators, like others in other cities in other years, were creating an improvised university of the streets. They were teaching, in this case, a masterpiece. But so doing, they were displaying the traditional, well-known doubleness of the humanities. That is, the humanities are first a vast repertoire of activities, artifacts, and acts. They have form and content, sorry to be so old-fashioned. But second, the humanities are also a part of a curriculum that is to have an effect on students. That is, in various ways, to shape them morally, psychologically, and cognitively. And the curriculum of this University of the Streets was to form students who would turn against official power and turn towards the humanities. Now, important though these demonstrations might be in and of themselves, and by the way, I know you all know French academics, and the ones who were reading these demonstrations are so filled with pride and even a tiny bit of narcissism. Important though these demonstrations might be in and of themselves, they are part of a larger phenomenon about the humanities. The apocalyptic rhetoric they now inspire inside the university and out. And two horsemen of the apocalypse ride across a number of cultural landscapes, each prophesying the death of the humanities. The ones I know best, these horsemen of the apocalypse, are in the United States. But each of the two horsemen blames a different assassin. The horseman of the left blames the rise of big science, materialistic professions, the corporate university, and the Sarkozys in office. You see, when we lost George Bush, we couldn't attack official power anymore. The horseman of the right blames the left and the intellectual changes in the humanities since the 1960s, clumped together as theory and race, class, gender, post-colonial, post-modern, etc., etc. studies. Now, the names of both horsemen have their accuracies. Now, forgive my narcissistic flurry. I do have to point out there is a pun in names, as in the sound that horses make, and names, as in saying no. And I don't blame you for looking at me, Harriet, as if you wished I had never said that. Yes. Thank you. I have to add that. However, I wish to argue that despite their well-documented difficulties, the humanities are undergoing a period of creative ferment, and our task is to run around and ahead of the horsemen while never losing sight of the needs of younger scholars in difficult times. Thus, let me very briefly mention some prophets of creative change. One of the wisest is the American scholar Richard Lanham. In 1992, he noted the historically repetitive quality of the debates about the humanities. But he argued there are three new forces in play. The first is the humanities, like all of education, are feeling the social pressure of the democratization of education and higher education. And this democratization of higher education has broken the lockstep of the older curriculum. And the recent waves of immigrants who are entering the schools destabilize the monolinguicity and easy allusions to what seems an alien Western tradition. But the growth of democracy has resulted in the demand for systematic public accountability. Here, RAE, and many other names in my country. So humanists, as never before, are being asked to prove that they do what they say they do. The second new force, Lanham points out, is electronic digital technology. The fixed older texts of the humanities are now going into the pixeled word, the dynamic and volatile pixeled word, where the reader is active, directive, and no one reader can dictate a final cut. And then Lanham talks about a grab bag of other things that are new. He said, are we rediscovering the rhetorical paideia? And then he adds, in something, Don, I'm so glad you're going to talk about science. He adds that while we're not totally genetically determined, we do have a human nature. And if we can work with the sciences on questions of our human nature without falling into genetic determinism, can we, Lanham asks, invent an experimental humanism? Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to talk about what is to me the most interesting new book about the electronic revolution, and that's Alan Liu, L-U-I, a towering book called The Laws of Cool, Knowledge Work and the Culture of Information, which, Homi, I don't know if you'd agree with me or not, but I find it an astonishing anthropology of the information society. Now, Liu brilliantly explores the concept of cool. And again, I recommend it to you for the electronic revolution. Now, Lanham's essay has one gap. He is aware of globalization, but his focus is on its effect on the domestic demographies of the United States. But many more are asking about the effects of globalization for the humanities, including the cognitive and curricular possibilities of global humanities. And Homi Bhabha's Humanities Center at Harvard has explored this with great subtlety. So I think, for example, of Martha Nussbaum's Cultivating Humanity, a triumph of useful knowledge, where Martha is connecting the tradition of liberal education with such new fields as women's studies and with non-Western cultures. And she is inventing and calling upon us to use the narrative imagination. She is calling on the humanities to teach us how to be citizens of the world. And in partial contrast, there's Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak's The Death of a Discipline. To say that Spivak is more elusive than Nussbaum is like saying it's a hot day today. But she asks us to be suspicious of first world appropriations of emerging cultures. She asks us to be suspicious of the economic grids of globalization. But she pleads for what she calls planetarity, by which she says, reconstruct the humanities by prizing the knowledge and the gaze of those who are most marginal to globalization. For her, illiterate women in the developing countries. Now, if you really attend to the humanities, in all they're actually theorizing, in all they're actually practicing, and still take the job market into account, I suggest that we take heart. I suggest that we take hope. And I would like to share four imaginings of what I think is happening. And there will be 30 seconds for each imagining, because at the end, I have two other suggestions. One imagining, if you'd look at what's really happening, is of new groups who are taking humanities as their primary interest. And I suggest there are three groups here. All of them need some university training, some university grounding. First, there's the professional humanist, I among them. Largely, but not exclusively, academics providing the most advanced education in the humanities and very, very conscious of disciplinary norms. If I hear the word interdisciplinarity one more time, I am going to formally call for a moratorium, and then for a moratorium on the word transdisciplinary. A second group are the public humanists, who may be academics, and I think the range of public humanists is far broader than we know. It's not simply academics who speak to a larger public. There's a marvelous movie in the States, I don't know if it's come here yet, it's called A Night at the Smithsonian. And it imagines that all the creatures in the Smithsonian, living and dead, come alive. Amelia Earhart flies again. I suggest to you it is the best history lesson I have seen in the last 6 months. And finally, there's a new group that I call the community humanists. They are promiscuous about the media in which they choose to work. They're only loosely organized, but they're spinning networks of knowledge and curricular materials. And the paradigm of their work is Wikipedia. Wikipedia, which conventionally enough defines the humanities as a set of academic disciplines. My second imagining is of the questions these groups must explore. What are the survival issues we must explore? And Homi, you spoke very eloquently to them. But I would suggest that the humanities have been neglectful of religion, that if we don't do much more serious work with religion, notions of martyrdom, notions of blood, notions of the sacred, notions of transcendence, we will both be ignoring the world in which we live and a great humanistic subject. My third imagining is a new model of the human. Like many others, I have written about the emergence of hybrids that arise from the blurring of the borders between person and machine, or arise from the blurring of the borders between person and animal, a blurring that mythologies have long anticipated. But what if, in a recursive turn, What if we were to organize our model of the human person around the picture of Homo Faber? Humans as maker. Humans as makers of language, a capacity we share with animals. Humans as makers of the active, often murderous worlds of actuality. Humans as makers of meanings, and humans as makers of other worlds. This is for you, Liz. The worlds of fantasy, of the arts, of cosmology, are to adopt Aristotle's distinction between history and poetry. Homo Faber, as a maker of the might have been, as well as of the has been. Now, my fourth imagining is for a new name for the humanities. And here I echo that pungent, brilliant scholar of poetry, Marjorie Perloff. No Nussbaum, who finds new energy in the humanities. Perloff finds the contemporary humanities empty and self-emptied of meaning. And in a crack that sounds like something we heard earlier today, she writes, quote, "Inadvertently but surely, humanities have become social science without the statistics." Now, given this climate, she adds, we need to think seriously about the state of the humanities. As she suggests, we should get rid of the word humanities. Now, I have taken her seriously, and here is my suggestion for making the word become the thing. And my suggestion flows from my thoughts about reconstructing our notion of the human person around Homo Faber. Inside the university, embedded in the curriculum, should be research and teaching about creativity and creations. In brief, all our makings. I want to assure you I am not a creationist. But what if we turned our humanities departments into studies of creativity and creations? And because the university is at once fixed and porous, ideas and methods and people will flow into the university to nourish up our research and teaching. Tragically, creativity and creations will include destruction as well as construction, nuclear war as well as Homer, the tirade of a Sarkozy as well as a 17th century novel about desire. Creativity and creations will show the mutabilities of human imagination, intellect, and will in action. Now, my original title for my remarks was I, Miss Aristotle. And I do. I miss that clarity. I miss that subtlety. I miss that order. I miss that interdisciplinary and magisterial mind that has been brought to me by student notes, by Islamic translators, and by other translators. I miss him. A new Aristotle will no doubt be a beautiful computer that thousands and thousands have programmed. But classical Greek or beautiful computer, both will be in the curriculum of creativity and creations. Thank you for hearing me out.